Huge areas of Australia have been ravaged by floods at some stage. Even as we speak, the town of Moree in New South Wales is underwater. Over 1,000 people were evacuated yesterday. Last year, we saw the incredible pictures of the Queensland floods. Hard to believe the ferocity of them. But what's it like for those who are caught in those floods? Your experiences of floods. We'll talk about that this morning with Ian Mannix. He's the manager of emergency broadcasting at ABC Local Radio and also the author of the new book, Great Australian Flood Stories. And Ian is with us this morning. Ian, a very good morning to you. I hope. Ian, a very good morning to you. No, we'll get to Ian in just a second. Hang on a minute. Okay, sorry, I apologise. We'll just get to him in a second. I apologise. That's my mistake. Totally my mistake. The interesting thing also, I've got to say, is many of the stories, and Ian will explain why in the book, the stories are about floods in the last few years. There just seem to be quite a few more in the last few years. Maybe we're hearing more about them. Maybe it's climate change, I'm not sure, but we'll talk about that presently.
The February issue of Gardening Australia magazine is packed with lots to keep you busy this summer. Jennifer Stackhouse shares her tips on growing perfect tomatoes. Matthew Wilson has some handy ideas for common storage dilemmas. Crisp cucumbers are the easiest veggies to grow. Maggie Beer tells you how to grow them and use them in soups and salads. And follow the February Gardening Diary. Gardening Australia magazine, February issue, available now from ABC shops, centres, good news agents and online.
Now we can talk to Ian Mannix. Ian, a very good morning to you.
Yeah, good morning to you, Rod.
Thank you very much. Firstly, before we talk about floods, just emergency broadcasting at the ABC, it's a massive undertaking because there's something happening nearly all the time.
Yeah, it's a busy place, isn't it, Australia? Droughts and flooding rains, bushfires. We've even tried to assist the community with locust plagues and other items where we foresee the need to assist people with information for both economic and natural disasters. So we're busy, and it's a great commitment from the ABC to do this.
And many people where things are not going on in their area may not even know about this, but in fact, generally, either there's coverage in that region or someone will break into coverage. So, for example, if there's something happening now, as there is in northern New South Wales, people elsewhere in Australia wouldn't necessarily know that. They wouldn't hear those reports. We keep people updated, but there's something going on, well, nearly all the time, really.
Oh, that's right. We've got broadcasters on at the moment assisting people in Mitchell in Queensland, and Roma will be issuing warnings tonight. The people in northern New South Wales won't hear those warnings. And we've got people in studios in Perth because of the storms that are over there. And obviously we don't want to overwhelm the community with constant references to natural disasters, nor do we want to issue too many warnings. We'd end up with warning fatigue. So, yes, the ABC through local radio has got a big commitment, and we try to be local.
Tell me about why. I know you've worked before on the book about bushfire stories, and that's also a terrible part of Australian summer. But why floods? Was it because of what happened in Queensland last year?
No, Rod. Actually, I started writing the book a little bit before that. The issue of emergency broadcasting is something that only the ABC practices. There isn't any other media organisation in the world trying to reach out to the community to issue them with warnings in the way that we do. In my role as the manager of emergency broadcasting, I need to know how we're being received in the community, and I need to be able to arm our broadcasters with as much knowledge about community behaviour as we can. Consequently, I go to the community to ask them what are they doing before, during and after an emergency, so we can learn from that, and then we know what type of information best suits people. So what I've been doing is travelling around the country to talk to people about the disasters they face and how they face them and where they get their information from, so that I can then come back to the ABC and assist our broadcasters by training them. And to give you a good example, through the flood book, it became apparent to me after talking to many, many people that the farmers who live in the upper reaches of rivers are often the first people to know about the impact of heavy rain. If we can get the information from those farmers early, then we can assist the Weather Bureau and our community by telling people what might be coming. Farmers have a very good understanding of their environment, Often they've been on the land for many years and they can generate a really good understanding about the impact of the rain or bushfires or storms on their area, and that becomes a warning, an informal warning for people in the community. These are the sorts of things people told me when I was talking to them about their flood experiences that we can use when we're broadcasting information, when we're collecting it, when we're reaching out to assist the community.
I know there are some occasionally amusing, you know, anecdotes or funny stories, but for the most part, these are really sad stories, aren't they, or devastating stories. Is that what you find?
Look, it's difficult to know whether people are, in fact, devastated by flooding. In fact, one woman whose family lives in a river at Emerald said to me, devastation is when you lose a family member. Anything up to that is simply a natural disaster. The stories generally of natural disasters in Australia are heartbreaking. There's no doubt about that. It seems that Mother Nature is overwhelming. She can't be resisted. No matter what people do, it seems that they're going to lose property, memories, their valuables. Often they're going to lose their house, their income. But mostly in Australia, natural disasters don't result in a large number of deaths. Places like the Grantham or Black Saturday are the exception rather than the rule. I think also Australians and probably every other country in the world tends to be stoic. They understand that Mother Nature can't be resisted, and so sometimes they do embrace these problems with a little bit more good humour or possibly black humour or even resignation. So I think when I put a book together like this, I'm not looking to bring people to tears or to make them fearful of their environment. But I think you're right. They are often natural disasters in the sense that so much goes wrong.
And floods are different to bushfires in a way. If a community is devastated by a bushfire and everything is burnt down, that is a terrible thing. That's a terrible tragedy, and then you've got to start again or you've lost everything. People tend to have a different view of floods, and that is, oh, they think, well, once the water recedes, life goes back to normal. But that's not the case, is it?
No, very, very much not the case. The problem is I don't think people living in Australia understand the impact of the disasters. Whether it's fire, flood or drought, for example, they are lingering. In the case of the flood book, I discovered that people are out of their home for something between 6 and 18 months. That's a significant displacement to an individual and to a community. But when you start thinking about why that may be so, it's easy to understand. For example, if your house is damaged, just getting the permits, getting the money together, getting the wherewithal to rebuild is a difficult process. Getting your mental capacity together to rebuild is a difficult process. So I think under those circumstances, it's easy to understand why there is so much dislocation. But in the case of flooding, the dislocation is very widespread. When the Queensland Premier said last year that a third of a state was underwater, she was actually quite right. Or Victoria, for example, nearly a third or a quarter of the state was underwater at any given time.
Water
brings with it not just a heartache at the individual level where a house might be first up isolated and second up damaged, but it brings long-lasting infrastructure damage. And I was talking to one farmer in Emerald who will spend many, many years, for example, just getting rid of the weeds that were washed into his property from literally hundreds of kilometres away. He had no idea it would happen. And so that type of long-term damage is something that I do think we don't understand very well. And we also, I guess, are a little bit optimistic, aren't we? We would like it to go away. We would like life to return to normal. But in the case of natural disasters, it does take many years.
You make the point in your book, Great Australian Flood Stories by Ian Mannix, that nowhere is kind of immune from flooding. But it seems to me that there are some places that get inundated more often than others. Or is it just that we don't hear about some of them? You know, Queensland, New South Wales, certainly, even Western Australia. I tend not to hear about floods in South Australia, but of course they must occur as well.
Oh, that's right. And the thing that occurred to me, and I probably should have known this, common sense tells me I should have known this, but anybody who lives alongside an ocean or in a watercourse, in a river or alongside a river, is at risk of being flooded, even if the river looks to be benign, friendly, and a place of great leisure. It's almost impossible to go down to most rivers, for example, the Murray, which is a wonderful stream of water that tends to run in a in a recreational fashion inside a channel, but in the 1950s it burst out of the channel for thousands of kilometres. People had many months in order to prepare, but they couldn't hold back the water. So in Australia, most people do tend to live in or on a watercourse, and at some stage it's almost certain that that watercourse will lead to some sort of flooding and higher than the previous known level. And so if you put those two things together, you can understand that floods are a natural part of our lives, and that maybe we ought to start saying to ourselves, while it's beautiful to live on or near a watercourse or a river or close to the beachfront, maybe we should take a little bit more care.
Do we learn from them? What I noticed about the whole Queensland thing last time, when talking about Brisbane in particular, was people forever harking back to the 1974 floods, which were just close enough in memory for people to remember them, but I don't know whether they did anything about them. They thought maybe it'll never happen again. Now I'm sure people hopefully will be more prepared for the next one, but the next one may not be till 30, 40, 50 years from now, and perhaps people would have forgotten again.
Look, it's difficult, Rod. I'm a naturally optimistic person. I like to think positive thoughts about the way that Australians and human beings generally do react, but having now written a fire book and a flood book, it seems that we don't learn enough, that we don't pass down our stories, we don't try to look back into history and say to ourselves, well, what could we have learned from that? Certainly people like Chas Keys, who I call the wise old man of floods, and he's mentioned throughout the book, he's a professional flood responder. He was the deputy director of the New South Wales SES. He thinks we don't learn anywhere near enough, and he believes that there are a number of reasons for that. There's an actual human tendency towards optimism. There is a generational gap between most natural disasters. Even though bushfires and floods tend to confine themselves to the same conditions, the same environment, in fact the same track and path, there's often a full generation between major events. It's unlikely or unusual, for example, for places like Moree or Emerald to have really significant floods within weeks of each other. In the case of Charleville, they've had three or four floods in the last decade, but before that it was a decade before, back in 1990, and before that it was 1955. So, I mean, there are really significant differences in the number of natural disasters that beset people. And with floods, people tend to think that the last one will be the same as the next one. But what they don't then start to understand is that each flood changes the water course. It does seem that if you've set a record in a flood, it's only there to be broken next time.
Fair enough. I was in Grafton, roughly this time last year when the terrible rain was happening and the floods were happening there as well as in Queensland. And they had a list in the paper of all the floods. And it was practically every year there'd been this, either a big flood or, you know, it was every couple of years. And then you drive along the side of the river and you'd see the extent of the flooding and how far it had come up compared with the previous time. And yet along the river, along the Clarence River, which is a big river there in northern New South Wales, they'd done a lot to try and stop the flooding, you know, maybe in the last 30 or 40 years. Do most towns do something? Do most towns have they learnt from it and have made changes?
Oh, yes, so massive amounts of infrastructure throughout Australia on most of the big river courses. When you were at Grafton, Rod, I don't know if you were able to see the levee. It's an enormous piece of infrastructure. And to some people, it's in the back of their minds. But we've tried to tame all the big rivers. All the little towns have tried to build a levee that channels water past the town. Some of them have tried to build levees that are, in fact, reservoirs that prevent the water getting in the first place. They're a two-edged sword, these levees, and the infrastructure that's put in to try to tame these big rivers. Two-edged sword because inevitably it seems that the rivers are going to rise higher than the levees, higher than the infrastructure. In and around that area in sort of Grafton, Kempsey, the Maclay River, for example, the water is comes down out of the escarpment, washes the silt away, plays havoc with previous opportunities to try to build levees. I think there's 326 pieces of infrastructure in and around Kempsey, for example, you know, massive seawalls and gates that have to be closed every time the river levels rise. Some of these things work in the short term, some in the medium term, but inevitably a levee or an opportunity to hold back water or divert it does become a problem in itself at some stage in the future. When the river levels rise, literally higher than anybody can ever imagine.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much what happened in Queensland last year when the river levels everywhere in the southeast and the central and the central west were much higher than people could imagine, and it ended up evacuating whole towns in a screaming great hurry.
Our guest is Ian Mannix, author of Great Australian Flood Stories, which is out now by ABC Books. You mentioned Chas Keys, but there you've spoken to a lot of people. Most of the stories, I've got to say, are from the last 2 or 3 years, though, aren't they? You go back a little bit and you talk a little bit about the Maitland floods and other floods, I think, in Queensland earlier than that. But it's mostly in the last few years. Tell me about some of the people you've met. Joy Newton, for a start, or the story of Joy Newton.
It's a real privilege and an honour to be invited into people's kitchens to sit down with them for many, many hours and talk to them about how they responded to these floods. And I feel honoured that people were able to open up to me. The reason the stories are relatively recent is because that's what we learn from. We can learn a little bit from history in the past, but we know how communities respond. So I tried to make the experience in the book a bit more recent than delving right back into history. But the thing that joins the dots that brings all the people together is that they've suffered a natural disaster and are prepared to talk about their experiences, about how they personally responded. The experiences are, I've tried to make them as different as possible. So, for example, you mentioned Joy Newton. She's just a lovely salt-of-the-earth woman who, with her husband Len, runs a sheep property in the Gawler Ranges, right up high in the north of South Australia. A really experienced, cautious, careful woman and husband. They would do nothing ever to get themselves into trouble. They understand the land. They've lived on it for years. They're strong-willed people, and they got themselves into trouble simply one evening driving home through the Gawler Ranges in a dirt road. They walked through 4 flooded rivers, discovered that all of the water was running very smoothly at a very low level. The 5th river they got to, they didn't even actually know it was a river. It was just water running across a road. As you do in outback Australia, sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between a water course, a creek, a river, or even a road crossing, or what they call floodways. They didn't even know when they went into the water, and for some reason, Len and Joy's car just suddenly stopped, and they had no idea what was going on, and all of a sudden they found themselves inside a Toyota Land Cruiser, which was being turned on its side, buffeted, tipped upside down, and Joy found herself trapped in a seat with the car completely full of water. And she was able to describe how she got out. And how she gave up. She mentally gave up, thinking that perhaps was going to be the last time we saw Joy. And then she miraculously got buffeted, ejected out of the car, and washed downstream. The thing surprised hell out of her, and even years later, they cannot understand how they managed to get themselves into that trouble. Yeah. But it did turn out that as they drove into the water, an old fence, which was lying under the water, got connected to the chassis of their car and just stopped them. And then perhaps, and nobody's certain about this, but perhaps a wall of water came down. It was dark, it was night, it was raining, but Len and Joy are amongst the most cautious people I've ever come across. People like that are readily able to tell their story, partly because of the surprise, partly because they want to help others learn from their mistakes. But then there are people like the Sarguts from Drensmain property in outback Queensland who live on a river, and the river had been relatively benign. They'd lived there for a generation. The expectation they had was that they'd get plenty of warning. But when their river came up, it came up in an hour. It probably travelled 300 metres, and they thought a dam had burst upstream. There are a lot of dams on rivers in Queensland, some legal, some illegal, but that's what they thought the problem was. So therefore, they, in their mindset, thought that the river would go down very quickly, but it was actually just another rainstorm coming from the Carnarvon Ranges, and their river came up before they knew it. They had to carry Helen across what was an old road, but and up to the only sand dune on their property, and they stayed there shivering and freezing all night, and when the sun came up the next day, they discovered the river had actually washed the road away. There was now a 3-metre drop in front of their house, which used to be the old road. These are people who live in the country, in the rural areas. They're resilient, friendly, obviously, and willing to share their stories. But the other end, of course, is the people who live in the towns, which are a bit more urban. Their properties are often smaller. They have less wherewithal. So when you get the massive flash flooding, that's really takes people by surprise. In Mackay a few years ago, they had 640 millimetres of rain in 4 hours, and much of the town was flooded in with no idea what was going on. The drains couldn't cope, the rivers couldn't cope. The flash flooding was forecast, but nothing like 640 mils of rain in 4 hours. It was hard to see. That's how deep the rain was. And so the people there were taken completely by surprise, barely had time to even move from one room to the other and get dry clothes. They were very surprised, but the community of Mackay came together immediately, and the neighbours started rescuing neighbours and helping each other and recognising who was at greater risk. Often, though, the people who are dealing with floods have some understanding of, or a better understanding of, what had occurred than that.
Yeah.
And so we get people who live on regularly flooded rivers like those at Kempseal Grafton or down in Victoria, in the Victorian East Gippsland area. Now, these people are expecting a warning, and many of them have got plans when the warnings come. But in the case of a major infrastructure or information failure, again, they're taken completely by surprise. And what you discover from the people who are dealing with these sorts of traumatic events is the first thing they do is look after themselves, and then as soon as they realise they're safe, they start to look after their friends and neighbours. But and that's universal. People really will put themselves at risk to rescue and help each other. The idea of a flotilla of small boats going from house to house in tiny communities, and these are people who are just fishermen, not necessarily the people who are trained from the SES, they're very quick to help each other once they've got through the initial shock. And at that point, you know, the communities start coming together, and then we see that outpouring of joy almost from communities where they realise that as a group of human beings, they have come together to support each other in difficult times. And there's a fair bit of that goes on in the book as well. Something that could help everybody is better warnings, better information. And if we're going to learn anything at all, then it would be fantastic if we could start talking to each other a bit more as a community, getting on phone trees, getting on Twitter and Facebook and any other mechanism that we have to quickly give a warning to the people that we know or who live close by or to our schools and businesses to say, this is what's happening to me right now, you might like to do something about it. We're really good at talking during and after, but we can do a lot more and make our communities a lot more resilient if we can talk before. And so you get these people who live in the high countries, in the upper reaches of fast-flowing rivers, who might call their friends and families and neighbours, but if we could just get that information and spread it a bit more widely through the community, then we're going to make ourselves all a little bit better prepared.
Take some calls in a moment. Something else I want to ask you. Ian Mannix is our guest, author of Great Australian Flood Stories. Maybe you have a flood story. Maybe you're in a flood right now. We'd like to hear from you. 1-300-800-222. Or perhaps you can text us, 0467-922-702. Phone number 1-300-800-222. Have you been in a flood? What was it like? What was it like returning to your home after a flood had been through? Perhaps, like me, you were born in a flood and feel that those, well, that river water flows through your veins. 1-300-800-222. What's it like when you, you know, the water is rising and there's not a lot you can do? You can fight a bushfire sometimes, but sometimes with a flood, you just got to get out of town, really. Yeah, Ian, there's not a lot you can do sometimes.
No, that's exactly right. The water is going to be generally relentless. It will be cold. I think that's something that people don't register, just exactly how cold it is. You may think to yourself you can wade around in water for a little while. So you soon lose feeling in your feet and your arms. Things that might have once been easy to move, a chair, a table, a lounge suite, suddenly become waterlogged. Physically dealing with a flood in your house is a real, a very significantly difficult thing to do. The cold water sometimes brings people close to hypothermia, and their bones start, you know, creaking, and then of course the heartbreak comes when they realise that either their family or their pets are at risk as well. I think it's interesting too, isn't it, that the people who respond to assist us aren't necessarily the superheroes of our community. There would be the Bureau of Meteorology with really first-class information, and then local government assist us in those circumstances. And more often than not, it's the local government fellows driving around in their trucks. This is the town engineers, the people who who know their communities because they're picking up the waste, they're picking up the rubbish, they're building roads, they're unblocking drains, and they're the people who often are the first people to turn up. But imagine trying to climb in the flood onto a truck which is sometimes 1.2, 1.3 metres high. It's almost impossible to do. So everything about floods becomes very difficult and physically difficult as well.
Just before we take some calls, not everyone has success. Tell me about Deb Wallace.
Deb Wallace is an interesting story from Ulmarra on the coast in New South Wales.
On the Clarence River, yeah.
On the Clarence River, that's right. She would be described as a very ordinary person, somebody who reached out to her community. She was she joined the Navy and then for a variety of reasons left the Navy and found herself at home doing a bit of study. She was a volunteer at the SES but hadn't done any training and other bits and pieces. And when the Clarence River flooded, she found herself offering to assist her community of Ulmarra, which is a small community, and yet nobody else could help. And so the volunteer component of the community had over the years largely fallen, I would refer to it as in disrepair. Most of the volunteers at the SES had enough and had left. The local community fire group was very small. It's a tiny community. There was no police. Locally, they would rely on the people up at Grafton. So suddenly, she found herself trying to provide leadership in this tiny community with a bit of rural hinterland, leadership that she'd never practiced before in a community which was largely unconnected. And so when the floods came and she was reaching out to people to assist each other, there wasn't anybody left with training. She found herself isolated in her own community. She didn't have any training about how you bring people together in those times. The township itself of Ulmarra hadn't practiced its own community development activities. People had come and go over the years. So when the floods came, she found herself alone, isolated and singled out as a person willing to provide leadership in the community, but ended up getting very little help. The floods came relatively rapidly. It was a three-day event. There was no time for training. There was no time to have a town meeting to bring people together to ask them to take responsibility for certain things. And so Deb found herself pretty much alone and isolated with one or two of her friends. It's interesting to hear her story because she was genuinely surprised at the lack of help that she got during that period. People were busy looking after themselves and the town didn't have a fully fledged SES unit at the time. And consequently, she found it very difficult and was in tears a number of times as she tried to motivate people to do simple things to assist each other. I found the story heartwarming. In the end, the town did come together around Deb. She was able to provide a lot of support, understanding, nurturing. She got a boat together and eventually found the former SES unit captain, and together they went out and they did the rescues that were needed. They delivered the food and the medicines. And by the end of the flood, it was a much stronger reaction than at the beginning. The other thing about Deb, and I think we shouldn't lose sight of this, she reminds us that she was already tired when the rains started. She was studying, she had a normal life. The rains started and kept people awake at night, and then the floods came. And so before even she could start to think about what she might put on her whiteboard in terms of a flood and recovery, she was exhausted. Mm. And then the floods came. And that happens to a lot of people.
Indeed.
So Deb's story is about how to provide community leadership, how important it is for people to volunteer before a natural disaster, to learn the skills that are needed, to learn about each other, to learn the networking opportunities, to provide their communities with the support they need. And then the last part of the story is about her resilience and determination in the face of what turned out to be a fairly difficult community, but that she was going to plough on and continue to supply support equipment and some understanding what was going on at the time. She grew a lot during it, and that I think we tend to misunderstand a little bit, that during these natural disasters, people do grow. The experience, although negative at the time, does bring personal growth, and people do develop a greater confidence in their ability to respond and that type of thing. So it certainly happened to Deb, but I'm not sure if it's a good story or a bad story. It's just a story about
Indeed.
A small community, and it just happened.
We may come back to that in a moment. Let's talk to Mick in Ballarat first. G'day, Mick.
Oh, g'day, mate. How you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Oh, it's good to have you back.
Thank you, Mick.
I was just going to say, you were talking about do we have floods in South Australia.
Well, I'm sure you do, just we don't hear about them all that much.
Do you know Manum at all?
Not at all.
Oh, like you got Murray Bridge and then your next main one, if you're on the water...
Rightio.
Your next main one is Manum.
Okay.
And it's got a two-storey pub, and in the 1950s, because all the way... It's marked all the way up how high it got to during the different floods.
Yep.
And the 1956 flood is about a halfway up, maybe two-thirds, but you know what I mean?
Okay, so that's a fair while ago. That's 50-odd years ago.
Second story.
Right.
And another thing I wanted to comment on was the community helping each other, because a lot of people that didn't need to be hurt and didn't wind up getting hurt.
Yeah.
In fact, the reverse happened because of the good old Aussie right of taking care of all my plot. Right, now it's time to go in and help everyone else, because just up from where we used to stay was a dairy farmer, and he was out with his tractor rescuing people and, you know...
And when was this, Mick?
That had the good old gutsy cry...
Yeah, Mick...
Gutsy Chrysler Royal and
Mick,
he was,
sorry, Mick, when was this?
Well, the flood I was in would have been 70-72, okay.
Right.
And the big one that hit, like, the highest point, because there's been a heap of floods.
Yeah, okay, all right.
The highest one's the 1956 flood.
Okay.
It goes up, like, halfway up the second story of the pub.
All right, Mick, I appreciate that and thank you very much for it. Ian, there you go. So plenty of floods in South Australia, sadly, but many of these places or towns and pubs do have marks that tell you when these floods reached.
Yes, that's right. There are two reasons for that. The natural curiosity of human beings to mark the latest river heights or the heights in their house. And if you do go along the river, the Murray River, from mouth to the... to right up there to Albury, all of the towns have some indication of how high the river had got. It's almost impossible to believe the height of the 1956 floods. You look out and you think to yourself, that water must have gone to the horizon. It's just extraordinary.
Yeah.
And those markers do two things. They obviously prepare people for the next flood, as well as giving them some understanding of what might have occurred before. But they aren't necessarily a very significant part of our community. And Chaz Keys believes that that's one of the problems that we face, that by not having flood markers that are more substantial within all of the communities that regularly suffer floods, people are encouraged to take them with or to be a little bit more complacent about them. If you enter into any of the towns along the northeast New South Wales coast there, all of them at some stage have had significant floods, but finding those flood markers is an exercise almost in futility. If you look on the website for most local government areas around Australia where flooding is significant, it's really difficult to find a flood map. And those flood maps are relatively easy to put together. So we do need to understand what the impact of minor, moderate and major flooding is. But we're treating these signs along the rivers and along the waterways pretty much as a tourist attraction rather than an infrastructure explanation.
Interesting. Elspeth is next. G'day, Elspeth.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just want to tell you about a Swedish couple. We met in our Williamstown city. They said they couldn't understand why we got flooded out and houses got flooded out, because in Sweden, their houses are built on, I don't know whether it's a balloon or something, but if they have floods, no matter how high the floods come, houses rise up and they never get wet. They rise up, they go up slowly with the water, and when the water goes away, the houses just slowly come down again. And all the houses in Sweden are built like that, and they never get flooded out.
Okay. Ian,
Never heard of anything like that
Anywhere.
At all.
Yeah.
And they wondered why.
Curious.
They don't build houses like that here.
Ian, what do you reckon?
I haven't come across that. I know that Europe suffers some of the massive floods, the same as Australia does. It would be interesting to discover how a community could afford that type of infrastructure. But there are ways in Australia that extra community spending will assist people in these circumstances, the biggest one being that houses should be built on stilts in watercourses, and those sorts of piles are going to help a lot of people, but they cost more money. And as you drive through Mackay or Emerald or some of the smaller farming communities along the northeast New South Wales coast, or any of the inland waterways, you're discovering more and more that houses aren't being built either even a metre or two off the water where they probably should be. And that's simply a matter of how much money are we willing to throw at this problem, how much planning are we going to be able to provide through the local government, what are our planning regulations that are going to say to people, well, yep, you can live in a watercourse, but you've got to have, you know, 18 piles under your house at 2.5 metres and a set of stairs, and you've got to be expecting to be flooded out at regular intervals. So money does help, there's no doubt about it, but we need the willingness and the town planning regulations to encourage us to do that stuff.
Ian Mannix is our guest. 1-300-800-222 is the number. There are plenty of floods going on in Australia now. I would like to hear from someone, if you've got the time, who is in a flood right now to tell us what is going on. What is your experience right now? 1-300-800-222. 1-300-800-222. Pete says, I spent a lot of time on the Upper Macleay and am always amazed when I see huge logs stuck a long, long way up trees. Visitors simply do not believe me when I tell them that's how high the river has been. It is amazing. It's incredible when you see those stories, because you don't believe that the river, which looks fairly benign when you drive past it and the highway's next to the river, you can't believe that it was that high.
Oh, you can't believe the damage that a river could do. How can they move boulders that sometimes weigh 10 tonnes?
Exactly.
In the 2007 floods in Kempsey, there's 1.5 kilometres of the Princess Highway was buried 4 metres deep in silt. For people who live in and around Queensland, for example, in the Brisbane to Toowoomba Valley along there, they would have seen buses and boats high in trees. After the Queensland floods last year, they would have seen rocks, tons and tons of rocks and cement and roadway infrastructure just moved as though it weighed nothing by the massive power of the water.
Paper Chucker says, the way in which the ABC is so superior in these reports is the local touch. Listening during the floods in Queensland and the bushfires in Victoria, the actual stories from people affected were amazing. There you go, Ian. That's a tick for you as well. We'll get to Peter in Bowen. Now, g'day, Peter.
G'day, Rod. How are you?
Not too bad. What have you experienced?
Oh, I come from New Zealand originally, but I was in Tasmania and we're in a shearing shed one day, and a chap said to me there, don't park your car outside there. I said, why? He said, park it on the bank. He says, it's been raining up in the hills for 3 days and it's due to come down. He's an old fella.
Right.
So I parked my car up on the bank. About an hour later, down it came. I reckon it was 10 foot high and 25 yards wide.
Good God.
Yeah, and we hadn't had no rain at all.
And that's what I was talking about earlier, Rod, with this business. Some of the old fellas, some of the people who live on the farms, the people who are aware of their environment, we can learn from them, so long as we take notice of them and give them an opportunity to talk to us in the wider sense. Certainly the ABC wants to hear from them, but if you're not willing to go on the radio, then getting on the phone, telling your neighbours and encouraging your neighbours to talk to others
and
to really build that networking is going to be really valuable.
Yep.
And there was also, Rod, there was the when it was raining upstream, we used to turn round and the fences near the river, we used to turn round and the posts had a piece of wire around the top, and we used to take it off and lay all the fences down. And after the water had gone through, a couple of days later, we just turned round and picked the fences up again.
Good God.
But there's one other thing I'd like to mention, and no one seems to mention it, is in Fiji here, just a couple of weeks ago, a whole village was taken out by a slip off the hills.
Right.
Where they take out, they take the rainforest out. You have a look at all the houses now. A lot of the houses, they're made out of concrete blocks, not out of wood. And what they've done, they've taken all the rainforests out. You can even buy furniture from over that way in the Philippines and Malaysia. They've taken all the rainforests out, and it's altered the weather pattern. And I've noticed in a line now above the Darwin, right through to Brisbane that way, right through the middle of Australia, they've turned around, and that's where we're getting all the rain the last last few years. I'll guarantee it happens again next January.
I will talk to Ian about that in just a moment, and I appreciate your call. Thank you very much. But I do want to get to David, who's in Roma at the moment, so it is flooding there. David, what's going on?
Yeah, it's been pouring rain all night. Roma itself is not too bad, actually, but west of Roma is all cut off in several places, and it looks like Surat St. George will be cut off today.
Yep.
I'm a bread vendor, actually, and I run through the charitable St. George.
Right.
And so I've got to sort of keep my eye on everything all the time. And it just sneaks up and sort of whacks you on your head without expecting, you know. Mitchell's absolutely horrid. But the interesting part of the flooding, look, we had this last year. The interesting part is that even though when you have the aftermath, people jump in and help one another out, the unfortunate side is while actual floods are on, people become the most selfish animals that you could imagine. Yeah, like we had physical fights in a supermarket over a loaf of bread, you know, and things like that. I mean, surely you can live without that. But, you know, the water's coming up. It's coming up slowly around Roma, but Mitchell copped it pretty quickly, virtually within hours. And it's looking like St. George and Surat will be the same. And once again, I think Roma will be just like a little island in the middle. We have little bits of, you know, flooding around the place, but I don't think it's going to be anything too bad. But, you know, just sort of keeping my eye on the... what's going on here.
All right, well, let's get back to work. But, David, thank you very much for that. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no worries. Thank you.
All right, David in Roma. Ian Mannix, our guest on Overnights this morning. Ian, just going back to what David was talking about and how, you know, changes in weather may be affecting us. What have you learnt over, you know, by looking at it, by talking to locals who've seen these floods come and go over many, many years? People talk about global warming, climate change, that sort of thing. What have you noticed? Or what have people said to you about maybe why we might be getting more floods than usual, or why they're worse than before?
I think the people who try to understand the environment work not in generations or decades, but in thousands of years, and almost inevitably, the geographical register, the historic geological register, tells us that these things have been happening over the years, over the millennia. Whether or not they're worse now than they were 1,000 years ago, it's almost impossible to say, but that's the time scale that Mother Nature works. I think people need to understand that there will always be a higher flood. That seems to be inevitable. So when you think you've worked out what's going on, then plan for a bit more. Interesting to hear that attitude from Dave in Roma there. Roma at the moment's under a warning, encouraging people to look out for each other overnight, and they're expecting a major flood tomorrow morning. Interesting for him to recognise that people respond poorly to floods, but really what happens with all natural disasters is your instincts kick in, and there isn't really much you can do once your adrenaline levels are up and the fight-or-flight mechanism starts controlling your body.
Yeah.
But it's really heartwarming to discover after you've looked after your family and friends, it doesn't take long before you do start to look after the other people in the community. But it does take a lot of people by surprise. The other thing to understand about the environment is there are times when it's going to be more flood-prone, and you can recognise those. When the Weather Bureau says we're in a La Nina pattern, they actually know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
They're very, very good at forecasting these things. And we were forecasting, or the Weather Bureau was telling the community that we were in a La Nina pattern right from the beginning of January last year. So that gave people 12 months of understanding, virtually, that there could be a higher level of rainfall than normal. And that's about as good as we're going to get with a forecast on a flood. And then we have to start trusting our instincts and have to start preparing a little earlier. So whether or not global warming is responsible, the Weather Bureau says perhaps there's some element of global warming being experienced at the moment, and that's why we have devastating bushfires, longer droughts and higher rainfall, or whether it's simply a part of the cycle, or whether, in fact, it isn't a cycle, but it's inevitable that one flood will lead to a higher flood sometime in the future. The other thing the Weather Bureau reminds us of, and so do local government and town planners and people like Chas Keys, is we bring some problems on ourselves by having a growing population and one that tends to want to live in riverbeds,
yes,
in floodplains and along the beautiful parts of our country. So the more that we allow people to live in those areas, the higher the level of devastation at the end. And then we will think to ourselves, well, it's all about Mother Nature, but perhaps it's also about our own willingness to want to live on or in a riverbed or one of the more beautiful places along a floodplain.
Well, I mean, people want to live alongside rivers. That's where they settled because that's where they got the water, and you can't blame them for that. But unfortunately, there's a terrible downside to that. You've written about bushfires, you've written about floods. What are you going to do next?
Well, I'll probably write about cyclones if we need to learn from cyclones.
Yeah.
In fact, I'll probably go away from these disasters. It really was an opportunity for me to learn a little bit more about it, to give some understanding to our broadcasters. I'm not a disaster expert by a long shot, but you do find the patterns of people's responses after these disasters are somewhat similar. They need to look after themselves, they need to scramble around, the fact that they can't remember initially the things that they should remember, but then eventually their lives get back together. In a lot of ways, they're heartwarming. So I'm not going to write an endless series of disaster books.
Ian, thank you very much, and thanks for your continued great work on ABC Local Radio.
Thanks, Rod. Good to talk.
That's Ian Mannix, and the name of the book is Great Australian Flood Stories. You'll find it in your ABC shop.